Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
The best way to learn a new skill or improve upon one you already have is to actually put it into practice. Choose from 6 hands-on training classes at Firehouse World 2011 in San Diego this coming February. Classes include trench rescue, firefighter survival, air management, extrication, and more. Learn by doing. Complete details available at firehouseworld.com.
Hey, welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand. This month we're going to talk about few things that have happened here in the industry, but we're going to start out with on a somewhat of a sad note, just to recognize the passing of two gentlemen who certainly have left their mark and impact on the apparatus industry and the fire service in general. First is the passing of a good dear friend, Mr. Bob Bearclaw. Bob passed away recently after a somewhat lengthy illness, and Bob had spent many, many years as an active member on the NFPA Apparatus Committee in charge of development of the 1901 standard, as well as having spent a good deal of his time after serving in the Navy working for several apparatus and component manufacturers. And Bob's guidance in the fire service and the apparatus industry in particular will surely be missed. Also, recently passed was John Kovach Jr., one of the founders of Kovach Mobile Equipment in Neskahoni, Pennsylvania. Mr. Kovach was responsible for starting the company way back after serving in World War II, and the company is still guided today by his son, John Kovach III, and our thoughts and prayers go out to the families of both Bob Bearclaw and John Kovach in what I'm sure is some trying times. So beyond that, we're going to Brother Mike's going to fill us up in on a couple of recent incidents of note that have occurred here in the last couple of weeks. Give us a update on this seatbelt study, which Mike and good friend J. Gordon Routley have been involved in very heavily together with some other people. I'm going to talk a little bit more about tool and equipment mounting and what you need to do to get that type of description and verbiage into your specifications. And we're going to be talking and finishing up with how to prepare for your engineering conference. Once you've signed a contract and you know you're going to your manufacturer where you've awarded the contract, some things you need to think about in preparation of that before you hit the airplane and hit the runway, as they say. So, with that, we'll turn it over to Brother Mike. What do you have for us here in some recent incidents?
Okay. Thank you, Tom, and hello, everybody. On Monday, January 24th, in the UK, a firefighter who had tried to drive through a herd of cows, causing them to stampede and crush the farmer, you can't make this stuff up, had been given a suspended jail sentence. Julian Lawford was driving to a car crash in which a child was reportedly trapped when the fire truck was held up on a country road in Somerset by dairy cows. Lawford, a 49-year-old part-time firefighter who had followed his father and grandfather into the service, switched off the engine's blue flashing emergency lights, but then turned them back on after becoming impatient with the slow progress. The herd panicked as he tried to drive through it, and farmer Harold Lee, 75, died in the hospital 6 days after the startled herd of 100 Holstein trampled him, leaving him with serious chest and head injuries. Lawford, who worked in the fire service for 32 years, had been on his way to help cut a 7-year-old boy from the wreckage of a car in August of 2009. He was approached by Harold Lee's son, Richard, 44, and asked not to spook the herd, which was on its way to the milking parlor. Simon Morgan, prosecuting, said a heated exchange followed, and Lawford told Richard Lee, "I hope your cows are worth more than a boy's life." Lawford then tried to drive through the cows, causing them to panic and crushed Harold Lee, the father, as he tried to calm them down. Morgan said the risk of the beast stampeding was obvious. It was obvious, common sense, They started to panic as a direct consequence of the fire engine. Morgan told the court how a passerby saw Lee lying in a pooling blood after the cattle trampled him. She saw the cattle in panic, climbing over one another in an attempt to get away from the fire engine. Lawford was arrested and charged with manslaughter by gross negligence, which he denied. He was due to stand trial in December, but minutes before the hearing, admitted a lesser charge of causing death by dangerous driving. Lawford's attorney said he tried to get to the trapped child as quickly as possible, and seconds cost life. This is a man whose family has been given 100 years of service to the fire brigade, his father and grandfather before him. The last thing that a man like him wants to take is a life. He spent years saving lives. Any comment on that one?
Well, Mike, it's not the kind of thing you come across all the time, but I guess when people talk about the common buzzword today is situational awareness, is you need to think, maybe to stop and think for a moment about what the consequences of your actions might be. Something like that, I obviously don't have any personal experience and really can't comment on with any degree of authority, but the situational awareness aspect of when you're dealing with the situation that you might not be able to control, all the different aspects of that, probably need to be aware of those things. So what else do you have for us, Mike?
Well, just one other parting thought on that. The ends don't justify the means. There may or may not have even been a trapped child in a car. Often we go to responses like that, and what the initial reports painted was really not the true picture of what the response was actually about, but the threat of the cow stampeding and hurting somebody at that point in time was real, and we have to operate within the parameters that are laid out for us. Fire Chief Tom was charged in a responding crash. The chief of Marion County, Oregon, has been cited for illegal operation of an emergency vehicle after he crashed his SUV into oncoming traffic on the way to a fire New Year's Eve. According to the cops, the chief reached speeds of 62 miles an hour in the department's 2010 Chevy Tahoe and was seriously injured in a late morning crash, but is thankfully recovering. The chief was driving with lights and sirens on, but was trying to pass a truck when the two vehicles collided and his vehicle rolled over. And then the next series of events, as we're recording this, 100 million people and 30 out of the 50 states are under the threat of a tremendous winter storm. And it just seems like we just keep getting battered storm after storm this year in a winter that just is really a real winter, one like we heretofore haven't seen for a good number of years. And there are a number of apparatus that have been struck while blocking. One such incident was in South Metro, Colorado. The apparatus operator actually recently repositioned the unit at a motor vehicle collision and was providing a blocking function for the crews that were treating the victims of a collision. The engineer noticed two vehicles sliding toward the incident on a snowy, icy roadway. The engineer blasted the air horn to notify the crew of the impending danger. The two vehicles slid into the engine and moved it 5 feet. However, the engine did its job, and the crews were spared any injury due to the positioning by that veteran engineer. In Raleigh, North Carolina, an accident occurred on I-440, the Beltline, just north of Hamilton Road, when Raleigh Engine 1 was struck in the rear by a passenger vehicle while blocking for Engine 2 at the accident scene. Engine 1's personnel were inside the apparatus at the time of the collision. However, they were not injured. The driver of the passenger vehicle was transported with non-life-threatening injuries. And again, and what you really can't make up, in Stratford, Connecticut, on the notoriously heavily traveled accident-prone I-95 that runs the length of the East Coast in the U.S., the Stratford Fire Department in Connecticut has all of a sudden been reeling after the sudden loss of two of its engine companies in a crash on I-95. One tractor trailer slammed into engine one, and another tractor trailer slammed into engine five at just about the same time on I-95. Six firefighters received minor injuries and were treated and released at the hospital. They were responding to a two-car crash with injuries. It was snowing at the time. Certainly the weather was a definitive factor in this. The chief said two engines each would cost about $425,000. They were parked in a staggered configuration on the highway in order to protect the lives of firefighters, police officers, and EMTs, and other first responders to the original crash. In this positioning of fire trucks, one is parked in the right-hand lane and the other in the center lane in order to both direct traffic around the mishap and also to provide protection in the event an incompetent driver happens upon the scene. And the chief said the system worked. Even though we lost two trucks, we would have been looking at six or seven fatalities or very serious injuries had those trucks not been in that place. And then, just really not too far away out on Long Island, a New York State trooper cites a fire chief for blocking the highway. The chief of North Merrick Fire Department was issued a citation by a state trooper Wednesday morning while attempting to close a lane to protect crews. Fire Chief James Allen said he was only trying to do his job when he decided to close the southbound right-hand lane on the Meadowbrook State Parkway after a collision occurred in the center lane. It wasn't safe. The weather wasn't good and cars were slipping and sliding all over the place. I had a victim and I was trying to make it as safe as possible. I have to keep my guys safe too. The trooper insisted that Allen allow the right and left lanes to handle the flow of traffic. Folks, this is nuts. It's nuts. You don't operate in the middle of a three-lane highway in a snowstorm and let either side pass by. That's crazy. A new move-over law went into effect in New York this year, and Allen said the safety of first responders needs to be considered. We'll have more on this as it gets adjudicated and moved up. And then the last that we have this month, and what can only just be described as bizarre, you can go to firehouse.com or emergencyvehiclerespondents.com and look at the video of a news story in which a Michigan Township firefighter is suing the fire department due to the fact that he was driving not well and on a rain-slick roadway, speeding, ran into a fire truck and was seriously hurt and can no longer work. You just can't make this stuff up, Brother Tom.
Well, Mike, it's like you say, it's unfortunate that with the severity of the winter weather that we've had here, that many departments are finding themselves operating out on limited access highways or any kind of traveled roads in hazardous conditions with people that seem to be more worried about getting home or getting to the pizza place to pick up the hot pizza to bring home because mom didn't feel like cooking that night. And like you say, a lot of these things, when you break down the whole scenario and look at everything, you would think we need to head to the fiction aisle in the local bookstore because you just can't make this stuff up. Mike, and you also recently attended the FDSOA apparatus symposium and put on a presentation regarding an update on the seatbelt initiative. For our listeners have been up to speed with what's been going on here, what's the latest here, and what are we going to be expecting to see happen here during the balance of 2011?
Thank you, Tom. We had a good show in Florida. Chief Routley from the Montreal Fire Department spoke about the history of the project and kind of where we are now. And where we are now is that in the past year, anthropometric measurements have been taken from 981 firefighters in four locations, one in Rockville, Maryland, another in Phoenix, Arizona, a third in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, And then we wound up in Fort Worth, Texas at the end of this past year. And as part of those measurement taking, regular anthropometric measurements were taken in about 36 different places. And then there were head scans, face scans, hand scans, and foot scans, boot scans, done for each of the firefighters. And the next phase is going to start. We're a little bit on hold because the federal budget has not been passed yet, but once we get over this hurdle, a full body scanner is going to be installed in a trailer, and we are going to do full body scans of 200 of the most multivariant of the 981 that we've done so far. So we're going to revisit those 200 candidates that represent basically the short and the skinny and the tall and the not so skinny and those that are on the outside fringe, and those folks are going to be fully body scanned with and without gear. Also, what we were able to do in Florida is to start offering to data that we've received so far on the initial go-around here to some of the manufacturers, and trying to get some of the manufacturers to partner with us to change the configuration of cabs and seats and seating and seat belts and things of that nature. And that tended to go really well. We have meetings coming up when we go to the FDIC later on this year, or with some of those component manufacturers and a couple of the apparatus manufacturers. We're certainly interested in the work that we've done so far as well. And that was really great to see that we have so many people that are now interested in trying to fix the problem and make it better. And then also we had a fellow by the name of Bob Ferrier from Total Contact. Jen sent him along and kind of went through with the group what they had done, and then again to try to get them to partner with us to make the changes that need to be changed. And then finally I ended up with a segment on some work that we've been doing in the city of New York with seatbelts, and we are getting close to a retrofit of our apparatus with newer, more user-friendly seat belts that really have been built for firefighters to wear bunker gear and to buckle up safely in the apparatus. And we'll continue to work on that project moving forward with the idea that we are looking at a finish date of mid-year this year of retrofitting units that are 2007 and older. We found that the newer units, 2008 and above, the seatbelts work, and there's much more room, and the seatbelts tend to work fairly well. So we're dealing with older units in the fleet, and we've had four now different trial belts that we've tried and we're tweaking to come up with just the right design to use in our fleet. And so that's going well, as well. It's going very well. And look forward to getting that project completed by mid-year if everything goes continues to go well and according to schedule.
Right. Mike, with the plan to do the full body scan, you said on 200 of the firefighters, what time frame are you anticipating that might take for you to gain the results from that part of the study?
Yeah, we're hoping to have them by year's end, honestly. And what started out interestingly enough, Tom, to be just kind of work on seatbelts has really manifested itself into many areas of the fire service, including gear, PPE, seating, seat belts, room in the cabs, handles, and then we're getting ready to move into ladder rung spacing, whether it be on aerial ladders or aerial towers or portable ladders, to come up with something that's more in tune with people that are encumbered in bunker gear, that are less than six feet tall, that have to negotiate ladders with full PPE and saws and SCBA and all the other things that we need to accomplish on the fire ground. So that's going to happen moving forward.
Well, Mike, it sounds like some pretty good stuff. And while I know that was a large effort put forth behind the scenes to secure the funding for this study, it sounds like we're starting to get some real hard data that's going to be able to be utilized in a very practical manner from the apparatus folks to be able to assist them in the work and the design of units. It sounds like everything, just not, I know the initial thought was some things to do with potential width of the seats and clearances that we would have to have for the listeners, where we talk about an eight-person cab or a 10-person cab specifically, where there would be four seats side to side, typically facing forward. It sounds like, Mike, from some of the initial dimensional data that you've got, that where it looked like that, you know, we need more room, that potentially the days of having four seats side by side in a forward-facing configuration are probably going to be history.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct, Tom. The reality is that the math just doesn't work out. One of the things that we know factually now is that a 2010 firefighter takes a minimum of 25 inches and a maximum of 32 inches to sit down and have enough room to be able to put a seatbelt on. And you being the cab guru, how many cabs are 4 times 32 or 128 inches door skin to door skin on the interior?
Yeah, well, there you go, Mike. That's the thing. There's been, with the redesign of cabs throughout the industry as a result of engine emission changes that occurred in 2007 and again in 2010, we're just starting to see some comment and feedback from the folks that have purchased these units. And while at the outset you wouldn't think that there's a big difference between a 96-inch wide cab outside sheet metal to outside sheet metal to a 100-inch wide cab, you say, well, that 4 inches, it all went into the inside space to gain more room for the people. And while you get a lot of comments back from the engineers or the chauffeurs and the officers that there's limited room up there, both foot room and hip room and shoulder room for them to operate, the concept of trying to just squeeze as many bodies as we can, frankly, inside the cab, we kind of need to completely rethink our operations here. And arguably, when you get into the career service, there's not too many departments that I know that are running around with more than five or six people on a rig, and many times it's staffing of three or four. So, you know, we have to seriously look at the need for, do we need to have four seats side by side only because, well, that's what we got on the last rig? Well, if it's not working, and what you're telling us here based on the math, it pretty clearly is not working. We need to rethink the whole process here.
Absolutely.
Well, Mike, hey, good, real good stuff, and we'll in our future editions of the Apparatus Architects and our podcaster, we'll be filling people in on what we're doing. And with that, we're going to take a brief break and then come back and talk about some tool and equipment mounting and the things that your department needs to consider when you're purchasing a new unit. So it's Mike Wilbur and Tom Shanny, Apparatus Architects. We'll be right back.
When was the last time you were able to shop and compare with 350 fire service exhibitors all under one roof? Schedule time this February 28th through March 2nd to walk the exhibit floor at Firehouse World 2011. Check out the latest in apparatus, apparel, tools, and more. Plus, find out about servicing equipment your department currently owns. An exhibitor list is available at firehouseworld.com.
Welcome, and we're back. The Apparatus Architects, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, and we're going to finish up this one session. We're going to talk about tool and equipment mounting and some of the things that are need to be considered when you're doing that. I'm going to start with the bid process here. I mean, in later editions, we can talk about some of the requirements of what to do, as we have discussed previously and written about in the Apparatus Architect articles in Firehouse Magazine. But this specifically has to do, when you're purchasing a new piece of apparatus, what requirements need to be fulfilled by the purchaser, by the fire department. These are not things that can come from the manufacturer. So we're going to start out with talking about the different types of apparatus. And in accordance with the NFPA 1901 requirements, specifically in the 2009 edition, the table is 12.1.2. And it appears on page 32 of the standard. For those of you that have it or want to grab it or later on, kind of follow along, as they say. If you're purchasing a pumper, unless you tell the manufacturer differently, and again, that responsibility is squarely back upon the fire department, if the pumper has a body that has 250 cubic feet of storage space or less, and there's a very simple way to calculate that, it's length times width times height, divided by a number to get from cubic inches to cubic feet. You can ask your salesperson or the group that you're working with what the cubic foot storage space is within the equipment compartments. We're not talking about hose bed space now. But if your body has 250 cubic feet of storage space or less, by the standard, you have an equipment payload allowance of 2,000 pounds. If the body were a larger style body or a rescue engine style body that has greater than 250 cubic feet of storage space, then the equipment allowance is 2,500 pounds. That is the minimum. And as Brother Mike has mentioned several times, while the NFPA 1901 standard is an excellent standard and guideline that you certainly want to follow from front to rear, it is a minimum standard. So that is not to imply that every pumper running around from coast to coast, if it's got high side compartments on the left side and low on the right, that it's got 2,000 pounds of equipment on it or less, it very well could have more. But that is the minimum allowance. If you had an aerial device, no matter rear mount, mid mount, whatever the device is, whether it has a pump on it or not, and one of the infamous quints that Mike and I have talked about, the minimum equipment allowance is 2,500 pounds, which again, it is the minimum. Now, here's where the onus goes back on to the purchaser, right? When the unit is going through the engineering process by the manufacturer, right, they have to provide an in-service weight calculation, which would include the weight of the whole apparatus, the body, chassis, tank, all of the fuel system. The fuel tank is full. Whatever the water tank and or foam tanks capacities that you have, they are full. 250-pound allowance for each seated position on the apparatus. Whatever fixed equipment you have on there, be it a fire pump, a generator, electric reels, an air system, anything that's permanently mounted to the unit, basically. The ground ladders, suction hose if you carry them, and the associated equipment racks, and then the allowance, the minimum allowance per the NFPA standard. Your department then is required to supply a listing of tools and equipment, and that is listed on page 23 of the 1901 standard under section 5.8, minor equipment. And I think for many of our listeners and the readers of the Apparatus Architect series, as it says minor equipment, we just kind of glance over this. But under that section, it says specifically, a detailed list of who is to furnish the items. The items refers to equipment. And the method for organizing and mounting these items shall be supplied by the purchasing authority. So in order for you to get a valid in-service weight estimate of the unit, which means that plus or minus a couple of percent, when you load the vehicle up with its hose load, that you have specified in your specifications. So it's one thing that the NFPA, the 1901 standard, addresses the hose body by saying it shall have a minimum size of cubic foot storage area to accommodate the hose, a minimum of 40 cubic feet. It doesn't tell you how wide, how long, how deep, how many hose bed dividers, or any of those other details. That's left up to the discretion of the manufacturer when they're designing the fire truck. So you and your specifications, if you intend, for example, to have a large hose bed and to carry 1,800 feet of 5-inch supply line, double jacketed, threaded, together with 1,000 feet of 3-inch and 4 attack lines off the back, that needs to be put into your specification. You cannot write a generic hose description or the generic equipment description. Otherwise, now you are left out on an island. If the vehicle ends up being overweight, that is your problem as the purchaser. That's not the manufacturer's problem, right? So you need to develop and include with your specifications a detailed list of all the equipment that's going to be carried. So you just can't put down generically hydraulic rescue tool and ramps. That doesn't tell you a whole lot, because that just means you're going to carry some heavy stuff. You're not defining exactly what you're going to carry. And then additionally, in section 4.3 of the standard, where it talks about responsibility of the purchaser, and there's 5 different things that you're required to tell them beyond the obvious. How many people are going to be on the apparatus? If you're going to operate at elevations above 2,000 feet or on grades greater than 6%, and so forth, it states all hose, ground ladders, or equipment to be carried by the apparatus that exceed the minimum requirements of the standard. And again, it's the minimum. When you look at the required minimum equipment that the 1901 standard calls for on an engine company, beyond the hose requirements, the rest of it is pretty nominal and wouldn't take up a whole lot of space on a fire truck. And I would suspect that for most of our listeners, if you look at what is listed in that portion of the standard under section 5.8.3, you'll see pretty clearly, you'll jump out and say, wow, well, my department carries a lot more than that on our engine or on our combination engine rescue apparatus. You need to clearly define all of the equipment that's going to be carried so that you can, several things, the manufacturer can conduct an honest and accurate evaluation and analysis of what the in-service weight of the vehicle is going to be. That way they can specify the appropriate size axles, tires, and suspensions and so forth. And you've now, frankly, covered yourself. If you come out and tell the manufacturer, I'm going to carry 4,300 pounds of equipment on this apparatus, you're completely within your right to do that. And then with that, you have to have the ability, right, to be able to mount and properly locate all of those pieces of equipment into the body. And there's a couple different ways you can do that. One is that potentially your apparatus salesperson may be able, may be helpful in suggesting an appropriate array of trays and shelves and tool boards and so forth, so that at least you have a space for all your equipment. That's one starting point. The second thing is then more clearly you need to identify the type of brackets that you're going to utilize. Again, if you're carrying the equipment inside the cab, the standard is very, very specific with respect to the type of bracketry that you have to have that has to be capable of supporting a 9G load in a forward or rearward motion, and a 3G load side to side. There are several companies that are out there that make hardware and equipment that have been tested and certified to meet that standard. And that doesn't mean you take the standard axe with a scabbard and a tulip clip and mount that inside the cab. And to that point, you really need to consider what type of equipment you're going to carry or required to be carried inside the cab. Just because we have the space, and this goes to what Brother Mike was talking about before, and they ultimately have an impact not only on the seating layouts
but on how much equipment we decide to put in the cab. In the past, it's been kind of standard, even if we had seating for six, had an engineer, an officer, two rear-facing seats, and then possibly two center forward-facing seats, and then maybe we put EMS cabinets on either side, or we just call them their EMS or equipment storage cabinets, and that's where we carry all the other stuff. Now, Mike, to that point, just based on some of the preliminary dimensions, I'm getting the impression that the maximum number of forward-facing seats we're going to be looking at in the future, based on existing cab technology and WIS, is possibly three. If we were only going to put two people side by side, what do you think? What would the minimum dimensions that we need to say? What do we need for elbow room? If we're going to be just sitting side by side, what kind of space do we need to provide that in between those seats to provide adequate access for the members?
It seems like just from the preliminary work that we've done that if you're going to have two people next to one another, the way the apparatus manufacturers are taught to install the seatbelts from the seatbelt manufacturer is that the shoulder harness, the shoulder part, has to go be installed to the side facing the window or the street, so that if there was a rollover, that would hold you into the seat and prevent you from being ejected. Well, with that said, if you have two seats side by side facing forward, then what you're going to have in the center console are two female seatbelt stalks. And so there has to be enough space between those for each of the firefighters to independently be able to find his or her own female stalk to be able to buckle into. One of the original stops that we made when we found out how screwed up things really were was up in Massachusetts, and they had two seats that didn't have a foot, and one firefighter put his male end of the seatbelt into the female end of the belt that was designed for the other firefighter. And so there needs to be sufficient room, probably a foot at least, in order for firefighters to be able to buckle in and be able to see and discern what seatbelt end they need to go in.
Well, thanks, Mike. That was some of my concerns, is that, you know, some of the things that we're talking about here, we're talking about current day, standards, but looking forward into the future, what Mike and I have observed that over a period of time, because of the requirements of the NFPA standard and, more importantly, the development of some of these mounting systems and mounting hardware that were previously, you know, not on the market, it's given us the opportunity to carry more equipment both inside the cab and inside the body. And while that is all fine and well, it becomes very easy to, without any really preconceived notion or knowledge, to very easily have these units overloaded, maybe not initially upon delivery, but I think, as we've mentioned previously, there's been a number of departments that Mike and I have done some fleet evaluation work for and have asked the standard question, if you haven't had your vehicles weighed recently, we need to have you do that. It's pretty rare to have every vehicle make the available front and rear axle weight limitations based on how the unit was designed. So what's that saying? We very rarely get rid of stuff. We more often than not just keep accumulating equipment, and as long as there's space in the body, we do that. So when you're allocating the equipment payload and you have a properly designed, let's talk about a special service vehicle or a rescue engine vehicle, which is pretty, becoming more and more common, and you have available space left within the body to carry additional equipment, that's great, because you don't want to fill everything up upon initially purchasing the vehicle. But with that said, if you have in the cube of the body 15 to 20% of this available space left, where you can store additional equipment, you need to have the available axle capacities and vehicle capacity to be able to carry that equipment. So the two go hand in hand. Just because you have, you know, for example, topside compartments on a vehicle that are not completely filled, or area up over the pump that wasn't filled with components for your foam system or your generator or cable reels or so forth, having that empty space is fine, but you can pretty easily get yourself into trouble that if you don't have an accurate figure as to what your vehicle weighs separately, front axle and rear axle, and then total, you can get yourself into trouble pretty readily by having an overloaded vehicle. And unfortunately, we're here to tell you that happens more time than not. So those just briefly are some considerations of things that you need to do. If you're unsure, you can reach out and get assistance from an apparatus architect, from your salesperson, from the people that you're potentially going to be supplying the equipment, that you get accurate dimensional measurements and, more importantly, weights of this equipment. And as you'll see, this stuff totals up pretty rapidly. It doesn't take a whole lot to get to 2,000, north of 2,000 pounds, and where you thought that maybe 2,000 pounds was going to be more than adequate, you find yourself that you're going to be woefully short. So there's some thoughts on that. Our final topic this month, we're going to talk about how to prepare for your engineering conference. At this point, you've signed a contract with the manufacturer. You are going to go travel to their facility with your entire apparatus committee, or at least a portion of the committee, and some things that you need to do to prepare in advance for that. First, most important thing is to make sure that the key members that are going to be going out have a complete copy of your originally published specification, and that someone brings the original copy or a copy of the entire bid document that was submitted, so that if questions are raised over what the intent of certain language was or what the exceptions may be that were noted, that information is readily accessible. It's great to have this stuff available to you on your laptop, but at some point, since the bid proposal documents are all done, at least in current day technology, they're done hard copy in a three-ring binder with hopefully a proposal blueprint and all the other required legal documentation. That needs to go with you to the engineering conference, so you have that as a point of reference. Secondly, if you have not done what we just talked about, your tool and equipment inventory, if you neglected it, forgot about it, said, oh, we'll handle that later, well, then that absolutely needs to be done. Because before this, you start cutting sheet metal on this vehicle, and someone in the committee or someone within the department having to sign off and approve the blueprints and approve the specifications as they're written, you want to get, if you haven't gotten it already, an accurate in-service weight analysis of the vehicle. And in order for that to happen, you need to have the tool and equipment inventory. So if you haven't done that and you kind of sandbagged a little bit, it's time to get that list and bring that list with the associated weights to the conference.
This is crucial, absolutely crucial at this point in time. The days of taking the equipment off the old truck and backing the new apparatus in and trying to decide where everything is going to fit, those days are just absolutely gone forever. There's too much equipment. The vehicles cost too much money. You need to have an absolute ironclad plan as to where the equipment's going to go and what compartment it's going to go, and is it going to fit, and how is it going to be mounted within those compartment confines. It's just, we just go through this all the time with phone calls from departments that have neglected this part of the process or haven't done it very well. And now they really find themselves behind the eight ball. And once you sign the contract and this part of the process is over, unless you want to start generating change orders, which can run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars, you really need to do the work. The more work that you can do at the pre-construction conference and even beforehand, the easier the whole project will go. Don't you agree, Brother Tom?
Oh, absolutely, Mike. And to go to your point, you just mentioned about change orders. All right, that's one of the other things that you want to get out. Most manufacturers, and Mike and I are not in a position to talk across the board here and just say this is universal, but it's more common that the majority of manufacturers, up to and including the engineering conference, any changes, that additions and or deletions that you were going to make to the apparatus, typically the dollar and cent values that are attached to those additions and deletions are the same, would be the same dollar value as if they had been included at the time of your bid. So in other words, there's no penalty, almost like no harm, no foul. But after the engineering conference or after the approval of the documentation, the blueprints and the specifications as a result of that engineering conference, after that point of approval, now typically the cost to make any changes are much greater, because there are either administrative fees attached to them or just the dollar value of the desired change that you want to make is now greater. So you need to be able to consider that and get that out on the table and say, at what point do change order fees come into play or whatever. So you need to think about that. And once you have approved everything, understand that your ability to change everything, you know, without reservation may be somewhat difficult. For example, if a recent engineering conference that I was involved in, one of the requirements that the manufacturer had, which was very understandable, was to sign off on electrical load calculation. So in other words, the customer understood that there was potentially a limitation to the hydraulic generator system that was originally specified, that it was possible to overpower or have a greater wattage demand on the system than what the generator was capable of putting out, and as a result, some changes were made. Additionally, they had to sign off and approve the description, which there was a blueprint and a verbal description of the bar light, understanding that once you order these, many of them are custom ordered to the job. The lead time is quite long. You can't wait until 3 weeks before delivery and maybe went out for a mid-body inspection and then decide, you know, you didn't like that bar light. You realize you could have made it 8 inches longer. So now you're going to want to change the bar light. Those types of things are going to be difficult, if not impossible, to do. So you need to kind of understand the rules of the road. If you haven't purchased a unit recently, again, another great reason to get the assistance of an apparatus architect or somebody to help you, guide you through the system, or possibly even attend the engineering conference in conjunction with the personnel from your department to kind of keep everything on track and to keep things going. So there's a whole bunch of paperwork that you're going to be expected to do. And while it's, if you hadn't been to the manufacturer's plant previously, you know, starting out with a couple-hour plant tour, maybe kind of get your feet on the ground, so to speak, is to understand their process and how they're going to work, understanding that each manufacturer works just a little differently. So you may have bought 5 pieces of apparatus from brand A, but now you're buying a brand C unit, and you might find out that just from an administrative capacity, that department, that company works a little bit different. You need to kind of find that out. Some of the things you should be asking your salesperson or whomever you're working with through the process, if say, hey, if we're going to enter into a contract with you folks, what are the rules of the road going to be, and what are the different benchmarks and things that we're going to be expected to hit? So those just briefly some of the things that you need to think about. You're not going out there, no matter where the apparatus manufacturer's facility is located, you're not going down there to eat, drink, be merry, and go play golf. If that's kind of like your mindset, you probably want to stay home and leave that berth or spot open for someone else on the apparatus committee that's going to go there and do work. Additionally, you need to come prepared. If you just show up with yourself and a little tablet to write some notes down, you're going to be sadly mistaken and unfortunately potentially leaving yourself hoping to be misled because you don't have your reference material to be able to refer and relate back to. As changes occur, you want to be able to keep on top of these. And that's, again, with the laptop comes in great. If your manufacturer still is working with a handwritten process to develop the change orders, you can be typing and making running notes of these things as you go, in addition to kind of keeping a running tab of financially where you are in the process with respect to changes, whether, again, there are additions or deletions to the contract. So those are some things. We'll be talking about that a little bit more in the future. And just to wrap up before we let Brother Mike talk about some parting thoughts here, upcoming at the Firehouse World in San Diego, going to be a couple of programs that we're putting on. One thing that I know that Mike is just be really attuned to, 5 things your engine company needs to accomplish at every incident, and no, Brother Mike, one of them is not to not block the truck. We're taking that under the fact that our SOGs are we're going to do that regardless. So these are 5 more things in addition to pulling past the building and leaving room for the truck. We're also going to be putting on a program talking about fire apparatus purchasing, kind of got a brief overview, a little bit of what we might be talking about, what you need to do before signing the contract, all these things that logistical things that beyond the worrying about the front bumper layout and where the air horns are going to be left or right or both in the center, just some administrative and detail items that you need to consider before you ink the contract. And then finally, we're going to be doing an apparatus architect podcast on Tuesday, the 1st of March, in what hopefully will be sunny San Diego at 8:30 in the morning in room 30, C as in Charles. So some things to look forward to upcoming. So before we wrap up, Brother Mike, any parting thoughts on our topics of the month?
For all those listening, if you're an apparatus operator or chief officer, please continue to follow appropriate SOPs and SOGs as it relates to blocking. Just saw a number of events in the last 6 or 8 weeks where if the apparatus weren't positioned properly, the line of duty death rate could have just skyrocketed. So make a safe work environment for the troops while they're out there on the nation's highways and byways, particularly with the weather the way it's been. And if you are a driver, don't lose sight of the mission that you really need to just show up. And we know that this time of year that it could maybe take an extra 5 or 10 minutes to show up safely. But due to the weather conditions, that's the hand you're dealt. And that's the hand that you have to play, and that just realize that in order for you to get there in one piece, it's going to take additional time, and you're just going to have to live with that because the alternative could be far worse.
Brother Mike, great thoughts. As we say, that sometimes it sounds trite when we sign off and tell the people to be safe, but that's really what it's all about. In this time of year, just about no matter where you are in this great country of ours, you're encountering some weather conditions that are different, severe, and potentially in a lot of cases you just haven't seen in a long, long time. So all of your response policies and things that are written, things that have been drilled into your head, it doesn't do us any good if we don't get there and arrive safely. So for Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, the apparatus architects, to all our listeners, we look forward to hopefully seeing some of you here in the next couple of months at some of the upcoming events, and please be safe out there.
Firehouse is live. Video and audio training is now available at firehousetraininglive.com. Access the best of Firehouse events at your convenience for an affordable price. From communications to mass casualty to strategy and tactics, Firehouse Training Live can be used by volunteer, paid, and combination departments of all sizes. Get complete details at firehousetraininglive.com.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to Firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.